It is Friday, October 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Catalan lawmakers declare independence as the Spanish Parliament votes to impose direct rule on the region.
So we're back on a collision course with neither side really prepared to talk.
A U.S. senator describes policy towards Myanmar, and New Orleans remembers one of its own, musician Fats Domino, who died earlier this week. It's all ahead. Catalonia's regional parliament Friday voted to declare independence from Spain. This crowd reacted to the news when it was announced over a loudspeaker. The vote in the Catalan parliament was boycotted by anti-secessionists. Meanwhile, in Madrid, the Spanish parliament agreed to impose direct rule over the region. Lawmakers showed their approval. Jaime Detmer has spent the last several days in Barcelona, the capital of Catalonia. I asked him whether the independence vote by Catalan lawmakers was expected.
Yes, it was. I mean, yesterday there was a debate raging within the coalition that controls the Catalonian parliament about whether to offer early elections themselves in an attempt to preempt the Spanish government from moving to impose direct rule. That fell by the wayside when it was clear some of the hardliners wouldn't accept that. So, yes, overnight we did expect the declaration of independence. And, of course, we've also now got the Spanish Senate having voted to impose direct rule. So we're back on a collision course with neither side really prepared to talk.
Well, at this point, what can be done with this situation?
It's difficult to know where this is going to go because, as I said, neither side is ready for dialogue. We've got the hardest of hardliners now in control of this process, both in Madrid and Barcelona. You know, we've got, for example, the Catalan National Assembly, which is a group outside Parliament, which really doesn't represent the mainstream of Catalonian opinion or even the mainstream of Catalonian nationalism, very much driving this. Back in Madrid, we've got Rajoy under a lot of pressure from within his own party and with coalition partners not to back down. We've had Rajoy refusing to have dialogue with Catalonia, and then we've also had the Catalonian leader, Puigdemont, refusing to go to the Senate in Madrid to provide some kind of presentation. So there was a chance of a dialogue there. That fell by the wayside. So we've got neither side wanting dialogue, and we have no sign of a mediator either. I think what will happen is we've got the Spanish cabinet now meeting to ratify and move ahead on what the Senate voted. So we're going to see, I think, a staged process of direct rule and then some pretty large civil disobedience in Barcelona to move to close down the Catalonian parliament and to shatter the regional government.
Would there be a possibility that Spanish troops would be sent into Catalonia?
It is inconceivable, I think, for everyone, both in Barcelona and Madrid, that this will lead to a clash of arms. First of all, the Catalonian nationalists are actually dedicated to nonviolence. They've made that very clear. They're taking lessons in nonviolence, civil disobedience, for example. Sending in troops would really ratchet this up. I don't think Rajoy is near that stage. I think what we're going to see is a slow unfolding of the Madrid government trying to get control of the institutions in Catalonia, using the national police, using the civil guard, using what elements of the regional police are prepared to work with the Madrid government. As far as I can see, we're going to see lots of civil unrest, lots of civil disobedience, but I don't think this will lead to a clash of arms. I find that inconceivable.
And meanwhile, in Catalonia itself, certainly there is a sentiment for independence, but there are a number of people, including members of parliament, that do not want to secede from Spain.
Yes, I mean, that's, you know, very clear. There's an even split, actually, not even an even split amongst Catalonian opinion about this. Even in their own referendum, which they had on October the 1st, which was declared illegal by the Spanish government, they had a turnout below 50%, about 42-43%. 90% voted in favour. But opinion polls have, you know, successively shown that a slight majority of Catalans favour remaining within Spain, although of that group, of that large group, that majority, many would want more autonomy for Catalonia.
Jamie Detmer. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we talked about yesterday the JFK files and the eager anticipation on social media for their release. And after that big release last night, kind of a letdown. Nothing too scandalous that's come out, although people have been pouring through them and picking out bits and pieces here and there, looking at the connections to Cuba and the Soviet Union that were investigated, but eventually found to be unfounded. One instance that's capturing some attention is from the Cambridge News, which is a local paper in the United Kingdom. A document released said that they got a call a half hour before the assassination saying they should call the U.S. Embassy for some big news. And that was a lead that was actually investigated. And the Cambridge News, still around today, but in the digital age on social media, was posting pictures of them going through their archives, trying to find the information, trying to find the notes from that day when that call was taken to try to see what had happened. So combining those documents from 54 years ago to social media today. So pretty interesting stuff right there. But a lot of people looking at the fact that only 2,800 documents were released. They were promised over 3,000 because about 300 remain redacted and they're going under additional review. They might be released in about 180 days or they could stay classified. But
I have a prediction. That'll be some of the most interesting stuff.
And that's the prediction that WikiLeaks is making too. Of course, the big hacker group, they have announced a $100,000 reward for any of the withheld documents that show violations of law, inefficiency, or administrative error. So they want the dirt, and they're willing to pay for it. So that has captured quite a few conspiracy theorists and people who could use an extra $100,000, and really, who couldn't?
Yeah, right.
You might have to go and do some hacking to do that. That might not be advisable. But we'll end the week on a kind of a fun note. You know, President Trump, always on Twitter, tweeted out today wishing happy birthday to singer Lee Greenwood, who's famous for that song God Bless the USA. Just one problem, though. Trump used the wrong Twitter handle in that tweet. He targeted and thanked the wrong Lee Greenwood. @TheLeeGreenwood is the official Twitter handle for the singer. Trump used @LeeGreenwood83, which is a lawyer based in Washington, D.C., who's only tweeted 7 times this year. And one of those tweets is from an anti-Trump protest in New York. So, moral of the story here, always check who you're tagging on social media, especially if it's someone with a common name, and especially if you're the president of the United States.
Yeah, good advice there.
Yes.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The United States backtracks on the claim that Iraq and the Kurds have reached a ceasefire. Myanmar agrees to allow UN food distribution operations. The U.S. economy expands at a 3% rate in the third quarter. And the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations calls for elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo for next year. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Are you a daydreamer? Do you often find yourself staring out a window during meetings or class, lost in thought? According to a new study by researchers at the Georgia Institute of Technology, this may not be a bad thing at all. It could, in fact, be an indication that you are really smart and creative. According to Eric Schumacher, a Georgia Tech associate psychology professor and the co-author of the study, people with efficient brains may have too much brain capacity to stop their minds from wandering. Schumacher says people with highly efficient brains have a greater ability to think, which allows the mind to wander when performing simple and mundane tasks. So, do you think you have a highly efficient brain? The researchers say that one way to tell is that you are able to tune out during conversations or while performing tasks and then naturally tune back in without missing important points or steps. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Fats Domino leaves a musical legacy in his hometown of New Orleans. Britain has circulated a draft UN resolution that would condemn the violence that has sent more than 600,000 Rohingya Muslims fleeing from Myanmar to Bangladesh, and called on the Myanmar government, of which Aung San Suu Kyi is de facto leader, to immediately halt military operations in Rakhine State, where so many Rohingyas have been under assault from the Myanmar military since the August 25th attacks by Rohingya rebels that sparked the violence. Conditions in camps in Bangladesh are at best deplorable, according to many observers. Rohingyas have to wait in extremely long lines for food and water, and the number of cases of cholera are on the rise. Meantime, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of the state of Illinois and several other senators have just met at the U.S. Capitol with Myanmar's ambassador to the U.S. to talk about all of this. For VOA, Greta Van Susteren sat down with Senator Durbin, who told her many of his colleagues and others feel an ethnic cleansing is going on in Myanmar directed at the Rohingyas. Durbin was asked why this crisis should be important to the American people.
When it comes to American greatness, one of the things that we point to is when we stand up for things, values that count all around the world. These people, Muslim people, Rohingya people, are being terrorized by the Myanmar military. Their homes are being burned. They're being killed and raped and displaced in hundreds of thousands of numbers. They're put into refugee camps across the Naf River in Bangladesh and live under the worst, most deplorable, dangerous conditions. That's just unacceptable.
Well, according to the law in Burma, Myanmar, is in 1982, when they gave a number of ethnic groups citizenship, they specifically eliminated the Rohingyas. Why are they so resistant to letting the Rohingyas occupy that area?
Their argument, as I understand it, is they're not really citizens of Burma or Myanmar. They're really from Bangladesh. They are Bengali. And secondly, I don't think it escapes attention, they are Muslim. In a country where there is a Muslim population, but they are a concentration of a million or more Muslims within that country that has never been assimilated or accepted.
Well, apparently some of the people in the military in Myanmar say that these are terrorists.
And there was a terrorist incident, or at least a killing. You can characterize it as you wish. 16, we understand, Myanmar soldiers or law enforcement were killed. It was after some exchanges, some killing on both sides. But to argue that the response to that should be the displacement of 600,000 people is an outrage. It really went way beyond calling to justice those who are responsible, and it clearly is ethnic cleansing by classic definition.
And you're speaking about the August 25th attack, and since then all these people, they basically had a scorched earth policy, and there's been rape, there have been villages burned down, and they're trying to push them out of the Rakhine area of Myanmar.
Yes, northern Rakhine in particular. You know, we invited seven senators, Democrats and Republicans, invited the ambassador from Myanmar to come to my office yesterday, and he sat with us for over an hour and took our questions, and we'll get back to us in a week or two about his progress. What we're trying to do is to tell him we are watching carefully. Any relationship we have with Myanmar is going to be dependent on the outcome of this situation, and we expect results quickly.
Well, you've introduced a resolution condemning it, and you had bipartisan support?
I believe we will.
You have legislation coming.
I can tell you that the original resolution, John McCain joined me, and we think others will too. Yes, it will be bipartisan. But we don't want to wait for the passage of this resolution, as symbolic as it may be. We want results. I mean, there are people who are suffering at this point and dying. And we called on this government, called on Aung San Suu Kyi, to really step up, speak up, and do something. First, bring in some third parties, United Nations, NGOs, into Northern Rakhine, where they are currently being excluded, so they can see on the ground what's happening. Second, hold those responsible in the Myanmar military who burned these villages and were involved in these atrocities. Third, if there's going to be repatriation, bring in the UNHCR, the High Commission on Refugees, to bring these people back in an orderly way, demanding papers from people who have been completely displaced from their homes and their homes burned in front of them is unrealistic.
Aung San Suu Kyi, there was so much hope that she would be the one who would answer this or solve this problem, or at least to pull back some of the oppression of the Rohingyas. She had the Nobel Peace Prize. She was a secret pen pal to Laura Bush when she was First Lady of the United States. There are some headlines that say she's complicit because she has failed to speak so to condemn this. What's your thought on Aung San Suu Kyi?
I admire her so much. I mean, there she was under house arrest for more than a decade, just determined to stand up for what she thought was the beginning of a democracy in her country, and she prevailed. She has a position of leadership. She's far from the strong leader that country needs. They're in transition from military control to democracy. It's been less than 2 years that they've been at it. But she needs to be much more forceful and forthcoming when it comes to this atrocity within her own country.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. He was speaking with Greta Van Susteren. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Perhaps nowhere is the death of rock and roll pioneer Fats Domino felt as keenly as in the southern city of New Orleans, Louisiana. Domino died this week at the age of 89. Domino lived his entire life in the city, which is world famous for its music. Keith Spira writes about music for the New Orleans Advocate newspaper. I asked him about Domino's place among the great artists of popular music.
He was one of the founding fathers of rock and roll. He was there as rhythm and blues made that transition, and it's argued exactly when and where that transition actually took place. But arguably, his first single in 1949, The Fat Man, was one of the very first pure rock and roll records. So his success throughout the 1950s really put New Orleans on the map in terms of popular music. You know, he sold more records in the 50s, apparently, than anybody other than Elvis Presley. And most of that music was created in New Orleans with fellow New Orleans musicians. So it was very much a New Orleans sound that he brought to the world.
And I believe Elvis, who was from a bit further north in Memphis and also northern Mississippi, he credited Fats Domino with contributing a lot to rock and roll.
Absolutely. Elvis was very much a Fats Domino fan and said so several times throughout his lifetime, for sure. He said Fats was the real king of rock and roll.
Now, he, I think, was among the inaugural class who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that speaks to his role as a founding father. I mean, when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame opened up, you know, it was Fats, Elvis, James Brown, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Jerry Lee Lewis, Sam Cooke, the Everly Brothers, and Little Richard. I mean, those guys were acknowledged as the artists that had to be in there right away.
Now, he lived in New Orleans his entire life, but he did tour for a number of years, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a globetrotter. He went all over the world. He had this band that was a very hot band led by Dave Bartholomew, the guy that produced his records and co-wrote most of the songs with him. So, I mean, these guys played to some of the very first integrated audiences in the 50s throughout America. You know, Fats was a very chill guy offstage, very easygoing New Orleanian. But he and his band could really whip these audiences into a frenzy. I mean, there were riots at his shows, but I would say good-natured riots because people were so excited and having a good time.
Yeah, it's nice expression, good-natured riot.
Yeah,
he was very much a New Orleanian, very much belonged to the Crescent City. What kind of an impact has his death had on the city?
Well, you know, people feel it personally because he wasn't a removed superstar. He didn't live, you know, an exclusive part of town. He lived in the same neighborhood in the lower Ninth Ward that he lived in basically his whole life. He built a house in 1960, and he was there until Hurricane Katrina. He was out and about in the neighborhood all the time. He liked hanging out at the house with people from the neighborhood. He liked going to the grocery store. He liked being out and amongst the people. That was really where he was most comfortable, especially in his later years.
And speaking of Hurricane Katrina, when that happened, there were even false reports that he had died.
Yeah, I mean, he stayed at the house during Katrina, and as everybody knows, the Lower Ninth Ward was devastated. The levees broke nearby. The neighborhood had 10 feet of water probably on Fats' Street, so he kind of retreated to the second floor of his house and was eventually rescued by boat, by a harbor police boat, kind of pulled him and some members of his family off the second floor balcony. But he was kind of lost in the chaos for a little while. He went to the Superdome with other evacuees that made his way to Baton Rouge. No one for a while knew where he was, and he wasn't in contact with anyone. So you're right. I mean, rumors spread that he had perished in the storm, but fortunately he did not. And, you know, he, as soon as he could come back, he did. He was never able to go back to his house in the Ninth Ward. He bought a house across the river, across the Mississippi River from New Orleans in Harvey, and lived there for the rest of his life. But his house in the Ninth Ward was restored and kind of became this New Orleans music landmark.
Have any plans been announced yet for his funeral? And will he get that traditional, you know, New Orleans goodbye to prominent musicians?
You know, I know a lot of his fans want that. They have not announced any plans yet. His family is very private. You know, word of his death was kept secret for more than a day, actually, before it actually got out. But I suspect that ultimately they're going to do something like Alan Toussaint's funeral a couple of years ago, another great New Orleans piano player, where he was laid out in state, essentially, and there are musical tributes and prominent speakers. I mean, that's really what Fats deserves and what I think the city really wants to have some of that closure. So hopefully that'll come together.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry.
That's Domino closes our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson recently participated in the inaugural meeting of the Saudi Arabia-Iraq Coordination Council. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iraq is vital to bolstering our collective security and prosperity, and we take great interest in it, said Mr. Tillerson. The reopening of relations between Saudi Arabia and Iraq is extremely important to Iraq as it looks to develop a secure, stable economy with the capacity to meet the needs of all its citizens. In particular, said Secretary Tillerson, Iraq wants to develop the governmental capacities to resist any outside influence, that they are a country that now is able to stand on their own. During meetings with King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Secretary Tillerson discussed the United States' new policy to counter Iran's malign behaviors in the region. Both of our countries, said Mr. Tillerson, believe that those who conduct business with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard really do so at great risk. And we are hoping that European companies, countries, and others around the world will join the U.S. as we put in place a sanctions structure to prohibit certain activities of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard that foment instability in the region, including in Yemen and Syria. The U.S. is encouraged to see that Saudi Arabia and Iraq have made strides in their bilateral relationship, as evidenced by the recent opening of the Arar border crossing in August and the resumption of flights between Riyadh and Baghdad. Both represent the beginning of what we hope will be a series of even more tangible actions to improve relations, said Mr. Tillerson. As major military operations against ISIS near conclusion, Iraq's financial needs for stabilization and reconstruction are evident. The Coordination Council will not only lead to closer cooperation in the fight against ISIS, but it will help support the rehabilitation of facilities and infrastructures in the areas liberated. The Council will also contribute to reforms that will grow and diversify Iraq's private sector. Such reforms will encourage foreign investment that is vital to Iraq's reconstruction efforts, said Mr. Tillerson. The United States supports the continued cooperation between Saudi Arabia and Iraq through the work of the Coordination Council.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.